Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we are now in our fall pledge drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroix Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. All summer, Portland has been the brunt of vicious attacks by Trump and his minions, denouncing the city as a liberal democratic bastion under siege by mobs of radical anarchist thugs. After sending in uninvited federal police to put down the city's nightly Black Lives Matter protests, violent Trump supporters are now invading Portland and environs with boat and car rallies. So it's a good time to talk again with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about how we move forward in realizing our visions in this time of pandemic, recession, and wildfires during the remaining weeks of the most nerve-shattering election we can remember. Joanne, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back, Barbara.
Well, before we start, I just want to mention that we were recording this on Thursday, September 10th. The skies are full of smoke. There's actually a zone one evacuation zone just less than a mile from my house. So I think a lot of us at this moment are really kind of on tenterhooks watching the state burn up. So in that context, we'll talk about politics. So Joanne, we talked 3 months ago, and I just remember you saying back then that you felt like you had an army of 15,000 people with you. I'm wondering if you still feel that that's true.
I absolutely still feel that that's true. I feel that the energy around this movement is still very strong. The demands are still very clear. And so I certainly feel like that there's an army at my back pushing me to do more than I ever thought was possible.
Now, one of the big differences between when we talked in June and what's happened since is that Portland has become a national target for the Trump administration and his campaign. We are the poster child for everything that's wrong in America, if not the world. And I wonder how you feel about that target and what you think might be the reason why Trump is so much concentrating on Portland.
Well, I think the reality is because Portlanders did what Portlanders do so well, which is we protest, right? When we don't like something, we take to the street. And the fact that his goons that he sent here were supposed to squelch us. It was supposed to silence us. It was supposed to make us go home and not demand police reform and police accountability. And he had no idea that all he did was galvanize more people to take to the street to demand more reforms. And so that's what's making him angry. What's making him angry is that it had the counter effect that he thought it was going to have. He thought attacking us, brutalizing us would make us quiet, and all it did was make us louder. So I understand his concern, but let me just say I am so proud of Portland because Portland has done what Portland tends to do, which is to push back against that kind of authoritarian rule because we're just not going to take that.
Well, actually, I will admit that his federal goons in the streets of downtown Portland got me downtown. I protested on the east side, but I felt very motivated to go down, figure out some way to feel safe as an old person to do it, and was very glad that I did it. There were a lot of very disturbing scenes. I was just reading an article in the Washington Post today about four protesters who were basically snatched off the streets by the federal goons. And I wonder what your take on when that was going on, what your reaction to that was, and how you feel now as the stories keep coming out, just how unusual in a democracy it was to have that happen.
Well, I think, Barbara, your listeners know this, right? This is the goons we send all around the globe or in the name of the United States of America. And what we saw here in Portland is what people of color have been experiencing from Homeland Security ever since the Patriot Act passed. And as devastating as it was to see our community members being brutalized, I hope what it did was wake people up to the fact that we have a secret police force that we deploy all over the planet. That if they did this kind of stuff to Americans, can you imagine what they're doing in other parts of the world? And so as horrible as it was for us, I think it opened our eyes to the fact, well, wait a minute. Well, where are these folks when they're not here? right? When I first saw them, I knew immediately that they were not military personnel, even though they were dressed in fatigues and they appeared to be from the military. As a former Navy vet, what I know is that the military has to follow the Constitution. You don't just go and brutalize and attack people because 45 tells you to. So I knew immediately they were not military. And then the more I asked of Governor Brown, the more I asked of our federal delegation, the more I realized that this was not only a secret police force, but it was a secret police force with no controls. And that should scare everybody, whether they showed up in your town or not. That should scare the daylights out of people. And so I believe that what 45 did was give the next Congress the opportunity to disband the Patriot Act.
That's a hopeful thought. Actually, when I heard about the young man who got shot in the head by a so-called less than lethal bullet.
Yes.
And I didn't know at that time, I didn't know for a fact that the feds were here, even though I've been hearing rumors and I believed that there were some people here who really didn't belong here. I wondered what was going on because that was as brutal as the Portland police can be. They seem to know that you don't shoot less than lethal bullets at people's heads. They seem to aim lower down on the body.
But now lately, I've seen video of Portland police having someone contained that they're going to arrest, pulling off their tear gas mask and tear gassing them in their face. That is a war crime. And if we were in war, those people would be prosecuted. The fact that they still have Portland police uniforms on, I find very troubling.
Well, that also brings us back to the fact that a lot of people are criticizing the Portland police, that the methods that the feds were using, with the exception that I do think that the feds were a little bit more brutal and maybe less trained or totally untrained as far as how to use rubber bullets, so-called rubber bullets and things like that, that the tear gassing in particular was the same kind of tear gassing that the Portland police were using before and that they're still using, as I understand. And now we're also getting all these cases of like police punching demonstrators in the face and knocking them down
yes.
to the ground. And this will get us to how the city council is responding to this. But what is your thought about what does this say about the Portland police?
Well, the Portland police were brutalizing Portlanders before the feds showed up. And they continue to brutalize Portlanders after the feds have left. I believe that the fact that Portland police were taking such an aggressive approach to Portlanders gave 45 the opportunity to bring those federal goons here. Had Portland police not been so brutal, there would have been no reason for 45 to have actually targeted Portland. And that, I think, I put directly in on the plate of Portland police. Now, let me ask you this question, Robert. What difference it would have made when the Fed showed up, had Portland police actually protected Portlanders rather than joining force with the federal goons who were attacking and brutalizing community members? I've asked Chief Lavelle that question. I've asked the mayor that question. And I think it's a very valid question. And the mayor said, well, what were they supposed to do? I said, stand between the federal goons and Portlanders? Because isn't that what they were hired to do, protect and serve Portland, not protect and serve federal goons who are terrorizing our community? If they had done that in that moment, it would have made all the difference. And they missed an opportunity to really show who they were protecting. And clearly we as Portlanders know that they were not here to protect and serve us.
Well, I think another thing that's been very obvious is the disparity between the way that the Portland police have been responding to protesters against fascism and protesting for racial justice and this new influx of Trump supporters and far-right and neo-Nazi people who are invading Portland. And the police, particularly in the big Trump car rally 2 weeks ago, it seemed like there were so many instances when the Trump people violated the law.
Yes.
And they were allowed to get away with it. In fact, one of the things that really got me was that a lot of those Trump people had covered their license plates.
Yes.
A few days later, there was a protest out in towards your neighborhood
yes.
where there were the police arrested one or two cars for having covered license plates.
Yes.
So to me, that's a great disparity. And I know this is something you've discussed before.
Absolutely. I found it very ironic that Salem police could actually arrest Trump supporters for brutalizing counter-protesters, but somehow it was too difficult for Portland police to actually arrest people who were brandishing weapons at counter-protesters that were absolutely abusing people. I saw pictures of people stopping their car and punching people because they had Black Lives Matter t-shirts on. You know, if Black Lives Matter protesters did that, the Portland police would find them and they would certainly arrest them and they would certainly take them to jail. The fact that they what a pitiful excuse to say, oh, well, we've been doing protests every night, so we didn't have enough police to actually police when white supremacists came and took over our streets. I think that that was a horrible statement, and it really said a lot about the lack of priorities for Portland Police Bureau. Why do we need 30 police officers in riot gear outside of the police union office from 10 p.m. until 4 a.m. in the morning, right? That's not a good use of public resources. And so Portland Police continues to make really bad staffing decisions, and that was clearly reflected when the white supremacist rally took place.
Well, also, what was very disturbing to me is there are two instances where the police said that they didn't interfere with any kind of possible disturbances between the neo-Nazis and white supremacists who came to town and the Black Lives Matter protesters, that they just thought if their presence would make things worse. However, when the neo-Nazis and white supremacists aren't there, then they feel just fine on bashing on Black Lives Matter protesters.
Well, and as you may remember, Barbara, right after the white supremacists were safely able to leave downtown, it was declared an unlawful assembly. The whole time the white supremacist was there, nobody declared anything. And what happened? They came out and started brutalizing counter-protesters. The public is seeing what's going on, and we have video of it over and over and over again. So I think the good news is the public is no longer being hoodwinked by the PR machine that is called Portland Police Bureau.
Well, one other concern is that there have been instances in the past where it seems that the Portland police have some very kind of cozy relationships with the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer people, the ones who are in fact part of this influx of so-called Trump supporters. And I wonder how that gets rooted out, because to me that seems like that's a serious deficiency in the police department.
Well, I cannot speak to whether or not there are current members of white supremacist groups that are on the force of Portland Police Bureau. What I can tell you is that it's becoming very clear the difference between how police respond when white supremacists are protesting as compared to Black Lives Matter protesters. The police continue to tell me daily that there are few people that are involved in violent behavior. Supposedly, we have a well-trained police force. So you're telling me that they cannot arrest people who are involved in criminal behavior rather than gassing an entire community because a couple of people threw a rock? I mean, what I have seen over and over again is the over-response, the over-brutal response of Portland Police Bureau to what they say is criminal behavior. Police have tools to address criminal behavior, and it is not gassing communities. It is not running people down and brutally beating them with your baton, and it is not tearing off tear gas masks and tear gassing people in their face, right? Anybody who thinks that that's their job in Portland Police Bureau should actually give up their uniform and seek some other opportunity.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about how we navigate through the escalating tensions embracing our community and the world during this time of pandemic, recession, wildfires, and national political insanity. Well, one of the concerns that a lot of us have felt who really support the Black Lives Matter protests and support a complete reexamination and major closet cleaning of the Portland Police Department, we're also disturbed by some of what's going on with the protests. And I'm just wondering how you weigh this, because you mentioned that, you know, it's one thing if a couple protesters throw things at the police. But I mean, the fact that I think it was in front of either the police union or in front of Ted Wheeler's condo building that somebody set a mattress and a box spring on fire. And I just wonder, how do we approach those kinds of issues as well?
Well, there's no question that setting fires is illegal And people who set fire should be arrested for arson. I mean, we have all kind of laws on the book to address people involved in that kind of behavior. Now, what I've seen over and over again has been small dumpster fires or garbage can fires that primarily protesters are the ones that put out. Most of the protesters, 99.9% of the protesters, are not there to set fires, are not there to pick fights with the police, are not there to do anything but stand up for Black lives. And that's as it should be. The few people who use any kind of protest, it's not the first time we've seen this in Portland, where people infiltrate protests so that they can create violent responses. Not the first time, certainly won't be the last time. But that should in no way give the police permission to over respond when that happens.
Well, the other thing is that the very small group of people that are doing violent acts are the ones that the far right and the Trump administration focus on.
Yes.
And so to me, it's not just that they're disrupting life here in Portland and making it a little harder for people who do peaceful protests to do it successfully, but it also, to me, feels like it's raising the specter of a real kind of fascist turnaround on this country if people can start believing the law and order targeting that Trump is doing.
Yes. Well, as you know, if it bleeds, it leads, right? In the national news. And so I have friends and family all over the country that are calling me constantly. Oh my gosh, your whole city's burned down. What can I do? What do you need, right? Are you leaving the city, right? Are they evacuating, right? And so all that is shaped by national news coverage, right? And as you know, the right does a very good job of picking and choosing what they present to the public at the national level. And so they take very tiny events and then blow it up as if it's fact and it's the reality all over the city of Portland. I would just encourage people to do their own homework. I've always encouraged people to do their own homework. I take nothing as fact. So, for example, every morning I get a report from Portland Police about what they say happened the night before. I also go to every news outlet, every live stream I can find, and do my own assessment. I cannot believe what Portland Police says is what happened, nor do I believe any one source, right? So smart people know that they have to do their research and not just take things as a headline or something because some authority figure told you it was so. And in fact, I have pushed back constantly on Portland Police. Please, I don't need the narrative. I don't need you telling me what a great job the police are doing. All I need you to do is give me factual information about what happened the night before. I will do my own interpretation about whether or not a good job was done. And I reminded them that only the people can tell them whether they are doing a good job. They are not good assessors of whether or not they are effective. And as you may see, I've noticed the police are on a full court press PR campaign, right? This week, they released a document showing their staffing levels. And it ended with a statement, "We can't talk about community safety until you understand our staffing levels." I think Portland Police don't understand that they will never look the same again, ever, ever. That's what the public is demanding. And they have 888 officers right now. But how many of them actually patrol our streets? A very, very small number. They need to get people off their butt and get them out in the community actually solving crime. That's their job. They only have one job in our community, and that's to solve crime.
I'm wondering what you think about the local news coverage, because I've been reading the Oregonian more the last few months than I have read it in the last 10 years, and I have been pleasantly surprised by a lot of the coverage.
I have been humbled by the incredible reporting that has taken place in Portland. I know that every single day, media personnel are putting their lives at risk to bring to us what's really happening on the ground. And I am eternally grateful Because without them, we would only have the police narrative of what's happening on the ground. And so they have been beaten, brutalized, tear gassed, arrested, had their equipment confiscated, and they come back day in and day out. And so, yes, I think the level of reporting and coverage in Portland specifically has been phenomenal. And it has exceeded all my expectations. And not just the Oregonian, the Portland Mercury, Willamette Week. They've done just award-worthy work to make sure that the public is getting a very firsthand view of what's happening on the ground. And I am very grateful for that.
Yeah, I just saw a poll actually the other day, and I think 91% of Portlanders support Black Lives Matter.
It is absolutely phenomenal and what's funny is Black Lives Matter isn't an organization. It isn't an individual, right? It is a mindset, right? It is a mindset that says, now we're finally going to change these institutions, right? And so I love the fact that you could have 90-plus Oregonians saying they support Black Lives Matter when you can't actually pick up the phone and call Black Lives Matter, right? So I find that very fascinating.
One of my cousins lives in Florida, and she's one of the many relatives and friends who called or emailed me throughout the couple months saying, you know, are you okay? What's happening in Portland? We all have experienced that. And so she said to me, are there a lot of Black people in Portland? I said, how would you respond to that, Joe?
Absolutely not. No. Black people are 6% of the population in Portland. So no, there are not a lot of Black people in Portland. I think the reason why Black Lives Matter continues to show up and protest in Portland is because for the first time, a whole lot of very comfortable middle-class white people have actually come face-to-face with the brutality that Black and brown people have been talking about for 500 years, right? And for the very first time, people are like, wow, they gassed the whole community because there were three people that they were trying to get? Really? Well, why? They pulled off somebody's tear gas mask just for the purpose of brutalizing them. And so I think every night, Portland Police makes the case for why my ballot measure for true community oversight of policing is absolutely vital at this time. So, I of course we're going to run a campaign, but I think if we just replayed newscasts about what's been happening every night for the last 103 days, that would be sufficient for us to get 70%+ of the vote. So no, not a lot of Black people. However, Black people were over 50% of the stops by Portland police when they had a gang enforcement unit. When they had a gun violence reduction team, that number didn't change at all. And so if you do the math, and if you even believe police that crime, that gang activity and gun activity associated with gangs happens between 14 and 24, we don't have enough 14 to 24-year-old Black children in Portland to justify the enormous resources that are being utilized to target Black people in Portland.
Well, I wanted to talk about the very disturbing thing that happened, I think it was on August 29th, where there was a shooting in downtown Portland after the Trump car cavalcade came through. And interestingly, if I recall, that was the day after the Republican National Convention ended, which had lots of attacks on Portland during that week. When I first heard about the shooting, I expected that it was a Trump person who had shot one of the counter protesters.
As did I. I thought the same thing.
And it turns out it wasn't. Now, I don't know who this guy was that got shot, and he seemed to be a rather unhinged person from what I could gather, taking his 11-year-old daughter to these protests and she's carrying a baseball bat. That made me a little concerned. But I wonder what that says and how we can keep that incident from inflaming this mystique about Antifa and this radical left anarchist movement that Trump is trying to use to frighten suburban voters to vote for him this November.
Right. Well, let me just say that Antifa doesn't exist, right? Antifa is not an organization. It doesn't have a membership. It does not exist. So the more the right talks about Antifa and these radical left operatives, it is an illusion. It is an illusion in their mind. It is tragic that someone lost their life when they were standing up, exercising their First Amendment right. like you, I was pretty sure it was a Trump supporter because people on the left don't normally show up brandishing firearms. And the fact that we allow people to show up that we know are looking for violence to show up with firearms, I think is why some people on the left decided they needed to protect themselves. Now, we don't know the whole story about what led to the death, but what we do know was that people on the left were trying to save that man's life. What we do know is that nobody cared what political side he was on after he was shot. And I think that says a lot about who we are as Portlanders, right? When he got shot, people came, street medics came, other people came to try to comfort him. People held his hand until he died, right? Because that's who we are as Portlanders, right? At the end of the day, a man was injured and Portlanders did what Portlanders do. Now, my fear is what happens on the 26th when the same gun-toting, violent Trump supporters are planning to show up again in Portland. I asked Chief Lavelle, so what's the plan? What is the plan for the 26th? And he tells me that we're working on it, right? And because they're working on it and they don't have a plan figured out yet, I will tell you what my plan, what I'd like to see. I'd like to see a plan where there is no opportunity for Trump protesters to get anywhere close to the left. That's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see us stopping people at the border if they are brandishing firearms, right? There is no use for firearms at a protest. If you say you are standing up for your rights, bringing a loaded firearm and brandishing it should be enough for the city of Portland's police to arrest you or prohibit you from participating in a protest. The fact that these same white supremacists showed up at the state capitol and talked about killing Democrats because Democrats are the ones that are causing all these ills in our community, I haven't heard one Republican in the state of Oregon stand up and say, hey, that's not okay, not one. And that's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about this violent rhetoric that's actually directing people to harm people who think politically differently. And if Portland Police does not have a valid plan, I actually was at the command center August 17th last year when Trump supporters and other white supremacists showed up. And I got to tell you, Portland Police did a masterful job of making sure that their response was in line to what was happening. They had bicycle cops that were able to ride into the crowd and isolate people either for arrest or for treatment if they needed treatment. At the end of that day, I realized that women were in charge at every portion, every command station that day, women were in charge. I hope that's not lost on Chief Lavelle as we plan for the 26th rally.
Well, one of the things that I noticed, I was looking at the Oregonian video of the car rally as it was going over the Morrison Bridge and passing through a police blockade where they weren't supposed to go into downtown. And I'm not sure how the police let them go through, but they did. But I was counting license plates and it seemed like over half of the license plates, and this is only a sampling of about 12 cars that I could see, but more than six of the license plates were from Washington. I saw about three or four from Oregon and the rest didn't have any front license plate. Or it was covered.
And I thought that was illegal in Oregon. And in most places in the country, your license plate is supposed to be visible. And the fact that police are escorting people with their license plates covered, I find very problematic. And I think we should be asking the Oregon State Police why they are escorting people whose license plates are covered. Right? If you're brave enough to come and preach your white supremacist rhetoric, then you should be brave enough to let us read your license plate. I think they're covering it because they don't want us to know that these people don't live anywhere close to Portland, right? That these people are from out of town and they're just coming here to beat up on quote unquote progressives, right? I think that's why they're covering it. They're not covering it because they're scared that we're going to track down their license plate and show up at their house. They're covering it because they don't want us to know that most of them don't live here, don't live close to here, and are just here to cause trouble.
So is there a way for the police to, you said, stop them at the border?
Well, they should.
So how would this work? I mean, so they're coming over the interstate bridge from Vancouver, and there's a roadblock right at the Oregon side of the bridge?
I would imagine that if Black Lives Matter protesters were coming in with carloads of weapons, that yes, they would be stopped at the border. And I would expect nothing less for white supremacists who are coming in, right? Especially if you can look at them and know that they're already operating illegally. So if you're covering your license plate and everybody knows that's illegal, why would we think they would follow Oregon laws once they got here? If I was in charge of the police, I'd have a roadblock on I-5 coming from the north. I'd have a roadblock on 84. I would just make sure that they were not allowed into the city of Portland. That would be me. But I'm not the police commissioner, as you well know.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about how to navigate through the escalating tensions embracing our community and the world during this time of pandemic, recession, wildfires, and national political insanity. Now that Portland is the poster child for the radical anarchist left, how can we use that to turn into the poster child of something that's a little bit more productive?
Oh, great question. Well, hopefully we started with the November elections, again, with the ballot measure to create the first truly independent police oversight board. We continue to reduce the police budget and reinvest those dollars into community programs that make our whole community safe. I am starting right now community conversations both around the budget bump, which will happen in October, because, as you know, the community is still demanding that we cut $50 million out of the Portland Police Bureau's budget. I don't know if we'll get to that number, but we will reassess as we move into the fall bump process. And I expect to be moving proposals to cut some additional resources and reinvest those resources in things that make our community safer. In addition, we need a broader community conversation about really what is community safety? What does it look like? And how do we make sure that all communities can have that sense of safety? And that's a conversation that's gonna, I think, be happening over the next 6 months. What I hope is that this next 8 weeks, because I always call this crazy season, election season is always crazy season right after a Labor Day. But this one is even more insane because of the crazy man who is occupying the White House, right? So this has made it even more crazy than normal crazy season. The reality is that we as Portlanders, and I've seen this all over social media, need to actually be showing the world what's really happening in Portland, right? Showing them people actually involved in positive activities, showing the progress that we're making in reducing the police budget and reinvesting in community initiatives. So that side, I don't think, gets out nationally as much as 45's rhetoric about what's happening in Portland. In addition, we have so much more work to do in Portland. It's not like the ballot measure alone is going to fix what's broken. It's not like just having an election cycle is going to all of a sudden we're going to be wonderful. We need a broader community conversation that encompasses every area of the city of Portland to help us start reimagining community safety. And my colleagues on the city council are very committed to that conversation. My office is putting together some meetings now, and we're starting those conversations with young BIPOC youth, so because those are the ones that are most impacted both by the rhetoric and by the lack of opportunity and resources for them. So that's my commitment. I'm also very fortunate that Wyden and Kennedy has agreed to help me with this campaign around reimagining community safety. I'm very grateful that they reached out and said, how can we help, right? So I think there are people that know really great things are happening, but they're being drowned out by the insanity of the white supremacists that continue to show up, that continue to wreak havoc in our community. And they're being drowned out by the fact that Portland police have not developed new strategies to de-escalate situations in the evenings during protests. If I was police commissioner, I would prohibit them from showing up, period, right? And definitely not in riot gear, not in what I call war gear, right? When you show up in war gear, what does that say to people? That you are there to fight. And I am also very frustrated with the police narrative about people who show up with shields and show up with gas masks are there to pick a fight. You know, I mean, I had to put a gas mask on. I had to get fitted for a gas mask to go down to a protest. And I thought to myself, what does that say about Portland that now we got to put bicycle helmets on? We got to put a tear gas mask on. We got to have a shield so that we can protect ourselves from things that the police are going to throw at us to try to hurt or injure us. What does that say about us, right? I don't want to live in a city where you got to get dressed to protest to exercise your First Amendment rights. So I think the rhetoric, hopefully, there'll be a radical change at the federal level so that January, we're really all focused on how do we rebuild coming out of this pandemic, right? That's what I'm hoping for. But meanwhile, I'm doing the work and putting the pieces in place to have those conversations, to make those budget decisions, and to make those policy changes that will ultimately change our institutions. Because what we are hearing is the police is an institution that hasn't changed at all in its 500 years of existence. In fact, it's gotten worse, more brutal, more aggressive. And that's what I am committed to making sure we change. I don't want those kind of police serving Portland. And in fact, the more the community engages in community safety, the less need we will have for armed responses. What we need is more Portland street response, right? A nonviolent, non-weaponized response to 911 calls for people, for our community members living on the street. And fortunately, because I was able to cut the police budget, I was able to increase the Portland street response budget. So rather than one pilot, we will have six, and the first one rolls out in October. So I'm looking forward to that.
You were referring to how we need to get word out of the progressive and the positive sides of Portland. There was a wonderful article in the Oregonian right after the Republican National Convention when Trump had warned, if Joe Biden is elected, your city will look like
I
Portland.
know, right.
So the Oregonian article was says, this is what's going to happen if your city looks like Portland. And there were 10 points. The first one was bubblers on every corner, the Benson bubblers. There were food carts on every corner. You know, and that, I guess that went back to Trump's fear-mongering in 2016 that, you know, if the Democrats are elected, there'll be taco stands in every corner. Well, Portland has those besides ethnic food from around the world. And then my favorite one was lots of bike paths and a bridge that only allows pedestrians and bicycles.
Ah, yes.
So if you have a bridge that doesn't allow cars, the next step is communism.
Yes, right.
And I thought that the Oregonian did a really great job in really lessening the tension. I've been sending that article out to friends all over the country, and I sort of hope that other people who see it will disseminate it, because it really, I think, sums up this fear-mongering and how ridiculous it is. So what other things can we do to project the image nationally that Portland is a place that is really ahead of the curve in dealing with some very serious issues and also doing some very positive things?
I'm hopeful that passing the first of its kind facial recognition ban for private use in Portland puts us back on the national spotlight in a very positive way. That's something I've worked on for well over a year. And it was only delayed because of the pandemic and the economic crisis and the racial justice movement and now the wildfires, right? So effective today, no public agency is able to use facial recognition technology within the city of Portland. Effective January 1st, 2021, no private sector will be able to use facial recognition technology in any place where public accommodation law applies. First in the nation, that puts us back on the national stage in a way that is very Portland-like, right? We are known for innovation and creativity, and I think that actually starts to change the dialogue at the national level. Just this morning, I was on the phone for quite a while with the New York Times, with a reporter from the New York Times, who has been talking to a lot of activists and elected leaders in Portland. And she said, so what are we going to do about this generational divide? And I started laughing, right? Because I'm like, there's always been a generational divide, right? I mean, it's like this, we don't have a new generational divide. Always young people want change, and they want it today. They want it now, right? Old folks like us who've been around for a while and who've been working for change for a while have understood that we don't get change overnight, right? But we've got to stick with it, and we've got to celebrate the little victories, and we've got to continue to work towards the big victories, right? And so I reminded her, this is no different than the 60s civil rights movement, right? Where we had people being brutalized every single day by the police. Right? Because what? They wanted to register to vote. They wanted to get a quality education. They wanted to live in a decent neighborhood, right? But it was the police, the arm of the government, that were the brutal forces. And every night we're seeing that again, right? So we have the brutal forces who say they're there to protect and serve people, but they're actually protecting buildings, right? I was asked by somebody in law enforcement, well, what if they burn down the building? Well, guess what? We can rebuild buildings that burn down. But when you brutalize community members, when you beat people and pepper spray them, you can't undo that damage. That damage is there for life. And they will always remember the brutality under which you treated them.
Well, one of the things that's most disturbing to me about what's happened since George Floyd was murdered is how many more Black people have been murdered.
That's right.
Have there been any murders of Black people by the police in Portland since June?
Ironically, and I'm knocking on wood, there has not been a murder by Portland police so far this year. Dan Handelman yesterday at City Council gave a number statewide that I'm not remembering. But I'm knocking on wood, and maybe it's because they've been a little busy brutalizing people in other ways. But knock on wood, so far this year, no. But we certainly have a lot of cases of Black people being arrested over aggressively by Portland police as part of the Black Lives Matter protests. We certainly know that police are very indiscriminate when it comes to who they are brutalizing out on the street. So I guess the only thing we can be thankful for is, as of yet, knock on wood, no one has lost their life at the hands of Portland police so far this year.
Another thing that's been raised as a concern in the progressive community is how there's been mentioned that during the protests, which started out really led by young Black people, that white people came and co-opted it. And I've heard people say that from different parts of the country. And I guess the biggest image is the Wall of Moms, which wasn't all white. And actually, that got addressed really quickly. And then there were the dads with leaf blowers, who I had this image.
Yes,
they're all from
Beaverton. Yes.
I want to just talk a little bit about the contradiction there, that I see two things, that part of it is, yeah, we have to watch for white people co-opting Black movements. But there's also this place where white people are joining as more than allies. I mean, they're really putting themselves on the line.
We need white people to be involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. Let me just start off there. And honestly, we need white people to not just be allies, but to be co-conspirators, putting their bodies, their resources, their energy on the line with us, right? I was so proud of the moms when they organized. And, you know, anybody who organizes gets to face criticism. You didn't do it right, right? You didn't actually reach out to the right people. We started this program talking about there's 6% Black people in Portland. So if all the Black people protested every night, guess what? No movement would have taken place. If only Black people wrote to the city council, we would not have gotten 70,000 plus emails demanding we cut $50 million out of Portland Police Bureau budget. So I applaud the white people who are actually following the lead of Black Lives Matter protesters that are engaging with Black people about what their needs and wants are. But I take nothing away from white people that just show up because they know something's wrong and they want to stand for what is right. I mean, I have no criticism at all. Now, and I've heard and read the criticism of white people trying to take over the movement. I can tell you that I've seen no Black people throwing things at police because normally Black people don't throw stuff at police. I've seen no Black people setting fires, setting mattresses on fire in the middle of the street. I've seen no Black people involved in behavior that the police would identify as criminal. And so what I would say to those white people is ask yourself if you are helping or hurting the Black Lives Matter movement when you decide on your own that that's how you're going to contribute to the movement.
Well, I hope you can have the conversation with those people, because that's one of my big concerns too. Is I want those people to listen to Black leadership and understand the difference.
Well, yes, and you know, I am a child of the civil rights movement. I am a child of nonviolent direct action. I have said that over and over and over again, but I continue to get criticized when I don't sign on to whiny letters that say, tell the protesters to stop the violence. As I've said to the governor and to the mayor and to the police chief, I will never sign on to a document that condemns violence that doesn't talk about police violence. Because how can you talk about community violence absent police violence, especially when police have all the weapons and community members don't?
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about how we navigate through the escalating tensions embracing our community and the world during this time of pandemic, recession, wildfires, and national political insanity. I wanted to end this show by getting into the fires that are going on right now, because this is really, it's on our minds, it's in our respiratory systems. And I think about, it's not just these fires going on right now, but I've had conversations with my wife about how, is it going to be like this next year? Is this what we have to look forward to for the rest of our lives? Which brings us to climate change, which is an issue I know that you've been in the forefront of fighting to mitigate. So first of all, I want to get a sense, like maybe metaphorically, what do these fires feel like to you? What do you feel like besides the fact that the woods and now towns are on fire? What else is on fire?
It's breaking my heart that so many community members all across the state are losing their homes, their livelihoods, and their lives, honestly. Because these wildfires are so prevalent. We've been warned. We knew that summers are getting hotter. We know that with climate change, if we don't do something radically different, that this is only going to become our new normal, with every summer having wildfires that are devastating communities. At the moment, my heart goes out. I actually talked to the mayor this morning. We're going to try to figure out collectively how we as the city can actually help support some of these smaller communities that don't have the kind of resources that the city of Portland has access to. My fire and rescue squad has sent firefighters all over Oregon to assist agencies in putting out fires. But it scares me, because if we had a big fire in the city of Portland today, most of my people are out somewhere else fighting fires in other communities, right? And so, again, I think we have to remember what we feel like in this moment as we come out of this pandemic, because we don't have much time to really address the climate devastation that is taking place, right? One of the best things that came out of the pandemic was the increase in air quality all over the state of Oregon. To be able to go outside and go, wow, you can actually breathe, right? Because there was no car exhaust everywhere. There weren't people sitting on the freeway in traffic, bumper to bumper traffic. That's what we have to get back to. Right? I don't want everybody back in their cars and going back to what they were doing before, which is why we've been so opposed to expanding I-5 and making those kind of changes, right? Because if you expand a freeway, you have to actually maintain it for the next 50 years, right? What we need less freeways and less cars on the road. And hopefully people will remember the fires that are happening and understand that this is just a preview of what's to come if we don't radically change how we do business. I'm happy to say that the city of Portland is strongly committed to climate mitigation. Portland Clean Energy Fund, our first funds, will be going out the door later this year in the fall to actually start having communities of color actually have a huge impact on changing our future when it comes to climate. As a side note, there was a young Native American girl who spoke at City Hall yesterday. And oh my gosh, I just couldn't imagine being as articulate, as clear. She works with watershed enhancement with the Native American Center at Portland State University. And I listened to that young girl talk, and it reminded me, if we adults don't screw it up, the next generation is going to be in fabulous hands. Because these young people, they get it. They understand what the problem is. They know what the solution is. And by golly, they're using all their energy and optimism to actually have an impact on it, right? You know, in spite of all the ills that you mentioned at the beginning, I'm actually very optimistic that we're going to come out of all of this a much more equitable, a much more caring, compassionate community. And we are going to have the kind of priorities that really center those who have been left out of the political process for a long, long time. So even with everything that's going on, I have this sense of optimism that at the end of the day, Portland and Portlanders are going to be so much better because of what we've experienced this year.
Well, I just kind of want to make mention of what's going on in Southern Oregon. I feel personally connected to it because I spent a lot of time down there the last year covering Jordan Cove. And one of the things that made me really sad, Road Climate, which is this amazing group, mainly of young people.
Oh, gosh, they're fabulous. I've worked with them. Yes.
Their office burned down in Phoenix. Yeah. This is where I think it's really important that we all become total Oregonians as opposed to just Portlanders. I was reading about the fire that's called the Alameda Fire in Southern Oregon, which started at the northern end of Ashland. And contrary to the Washington Post, Ashland didn't burn down. That was a little disturbing thing I read this morning, but that didn't happen. But Talent and Phoenix, which are the next two towns up between Ashland and Medford, were maybe half destroyed. And I saw footage of Phoenix. Actually, I saw footage of both of them. But Hannah Soule, who's the director of Rogue Climate, did a video. She took video driving through Phoenix and showed what was left and what had burned down. And it's really devastating. And I know these people, and they're all evacuated now, and they're all safe, which I'm very happy to hear about. But I think about all the work they've been doing, and to lose your office is really a devastating thing for grassroots communities. So I urge people to, you know, support them among all the other groups in Southern Oregon that have really been hurt.
Unite Oregon used to be called Oregon Action. We've had a Medford office for 20 some plus years, right? So I, like you, have a long time friendships and relationships in that part of Oregon. My heart truly goes out to those folks, because those are communities that have not a lot of resources to begin with in the first place. And so anything could devastate those communities. And so I share that concern, which is why I'm going to work with the mayor to figure out what can we do as the city of Portland to provide some support to those small communities. You know, in Portland, when we have really bad things happen, we are resilient and we're able to bounce back. Some of these small communities are not going to be able to bounce back as quickly as we would be able to in larger communities. And so I would encourage your listeners to do what they can, right? Whether that's sending care packages, whether that's sending resources to support those folks that are directly on the ground. You know, I have a pet peeve about Red Cross. I don't know if the Red Cross has been called in. But I am not a fan of the Red Cross because they tend to come into disaster areas, suck up all the money, and leave. They provide temporary, very temporary assistance the day of. But a week from now, they're still collecting the money, but it's not going to the people in the community that desperately need it. So I would encourage people to look for local organizations that they can send money directly to make sure it truly benefits the local communities.
For as far as Rogue Climate goes, if you go to their Facebook page, and just Rogue Climate, and search it on Facebook, and they have a list on their page of resources that are needed and also places that you can donate the resources to.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I will help promote that as well, because I was also going to recommend people talk to the Rural Organizing Project, because they have been incredibly active in those communities for a long, long, long time, and they do excellent work. So yes, and Unite Oregon, because it's been there also for a very long time. So there are lots of organizations there, but I think that's both of our message, Barbara, is give locally to the people on the ground that can make the most difference for the people on the ground.
And the other thing that's been heartbreaking is looking at some of the other communities that are being destroyed that are just these incredible scenic wildland areas. I think about the stretch along the Mackenzie River, an area that I'm really familiar with and I spent a lot of time. And that's really burnt up. And then Vida, Oregon, west of Eugene, has also burned. And so I think for me, I'm doing some grieving about thinking about places in Oregon that are gone. And the next step, I think, beyond the grief is to think about ways to help rebuild that. The forest burning is actually not such a horrible thing because forests burn and they come back. But I think what's new to us here in Oregon is having communities burn.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, right. We are not accustomed to having whole communities just disappear, right? But again, with the climate crisis that we're in, every year it becomes more severe. And so the longer we fail to act, to address our climate activity, the worse it's going to get. And so we can't pretend we don't know, right? Commissioner Fritz likes to say, we have to act because the climate is on fire, right? And truer words were never spoken. And this week we've seen it in action, right? So we get to rebuild, and we get to rebuild in a more equitable, sustainable way that protects and values our precious resource, which is our planet, right? We're going to have a hard couple of years in Oregon, but I have every confidence that Oregonians are resilient, and we are good at looking out for each other, and we will come back stronger and more equitable than ever before. So my money is always on Oregon to ultimately do the right thing and to make the right decisions.
Well, Jan, it's always great to talk with you, and I'm really glad that you're ending on an optimistic note. So thanks a whole lot for that.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Yeah, we have to give people hope. People have to know that this here is temporary, but what we do next is the most important thing. Thank you so much, Barbara. Always a pleasure. Look forward to next time.
Me too. Thanks a lot. Today, we've been talking with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best possible radio from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times, if you're able, by becoming a member of KBOO during this fall pledge drive or renewing your membership. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Next week, we'll rebroadcast the interview I did with Chinook Elder and Tribal Council member Sam Robinson. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.